Hey, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut and what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it. This week I sit down with my brother Tom in the last episode of season 1. Tom's had a slightly checkered history with mental health problems over the years, suffering from severe depression through his teens, after he never really felt like he fitted in at school. The education system didn't really work for Tom, and he openly admits that his mind was always taken over by limiting belief systems, self-loathing, jealousy, never really feeling good enough, and feeling like he wasn't liked by his friends were daily battles for him. Having battled suicidal thoughts, being expelled from school, feeling like he was in the wilderness of life, Tom is now in the best place he's ever been because he started an intense but incredibly rewarding journey of self-discovery and learning to love himself. I have so much respect for this guy, not least because he's my brother, but I just admire his strength, resilience, and self-awareness. But this was actually a really difficult conversation to have because it's tough to hear your younger brother suffer so badly. But I'm so proud of this episode and him. Here's Tom's amazing story. So as always, please leave all judgment at the door. Tom, welcome to the RUP.
Thanks for having me.
Finally, we get to speak.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
I know.
Long time coming.
I know. How are you?
Very good, actually. Very, very good. Back to work. After a bit of a layoff, which was tough to deal with, but I'm feeling good about myself now.
How did you deal with lockdown? I don't think very well though.
No, I just lost all kind of forms of structure. I wasn't unhappy. I wasn't in any kind of bad places during it. I was spending a lot of time outside, mm-hmm. Which was the best thing for me. But it did drag towards the end of it. After a while off, it was quite brutal. But I can't complain. Back now. So,
very good. Mm. I'm going to treat you no different to other guests, even though you're my brother.
Yeah.
So, why did you want to come on the podcast? You messaged me saying I want to do an episode. Mm. Why did you want to come on?
Mental health, you know as well, mental health is something that I've always struggled with from a very young age. It's only something that I've kind of got a grasp of fairly recently. Mm-hmm. And when you started this, I saw it as a good platform for lots of people to speak, but especially myself. Mm. Being able to speak to you directly and having other people listen, it's great, but being able to speak to you directly in an open forum, it's not something many families do.
No, it's true. Many
families don't sit down and chat really openly about their mental health, especially the age difference between us. We're not that close in terms of age. You were gone when I was...
Yeah.
You were up at uni when I was kind of going through the worst points, I'd say, of my life. Mm. And so it wasn't something that you witnessed. It was something that you'd come home and see for a week or come home for a holiday and stuff like that. So being able to talk to you directly, I feel like it would just bring us closer. But also the experiences that I've had are something that I believe a lot of kids go through, going through school, things like that. And so then being able to listen to someone who's gone through it and got through the other side of it will show them that there is a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. So yeah.
Well, I'm very, very pleased you're on the pod. I'm excited. I'm excited.
So am I.
Tell me about your story. I obviously know it. I probably don't know as much as as people think I know, because you often keep your cards close to your chest. Mm. Talk to me about growing up.
Yeah.
Set the scene for what Thomas Roycroft Davis was like growing up as a kid.
So, I mean, how far back do you want me to go?
As far back as you want to.
As far back as I can remember, really.
Yeah.
I was always very loud. I was always a joker. I was always a troublemaker. I was never, ever secure in myself. I always hated myself, and I projected that by being a bit of a knob, by just being as loud as I could, not focusing on anything apart from trying to make people laugh and doing all these stupid things, getting into trouble all the time. And that was a common theme from when I was, I don't know, 7, 8 upwards, probably even earlier, but I don't remember. I'll have to ask mum later. But yeah, I was just a troublemaker. I was always told that I was incredibly intelligent. Every teacher, mum and I actually went through some of my old report cards before this, back from when I was about 4 or 5 onwards. Every single one said, he's really smart, but he needs to work harder. And that is the picture of my whole kind of kid life. So yeah.
We'll get onto that a bit later, because I've got my own views on that, having explored it quite a lot very recently. But you mentioned there you didn't like yourself. Like, where did that come from? That doesn't just come about from around the corner. I mean, it doesn't just, you wake up one day and hate yourself.
No, I've actually done a lot of thinking about it. And I know exactly the point where I flipped and just, it wasn't a hate for myself at that point. It was more a need to have people like me to feel fulfilled. It came when, I won't name names, but there was a kid who I used to be really, really good friends with when I was growing up. And when we were about 8 or 9, there was a big fight in the playground. Half the school went with him. All of the popular kids went with him. I was seen as one of the popular kids. All the popular kids went with him. And then I was stuck with a lot less friends. And luckily, I'm still best friends with one of them now. But I was stuck with a lot less friends. And I just sat there thinking, why did they go with him? What did I do wrong? Things like that.
It's feeling rejection.
Yeah, exactly. And just that feeling when you're a kid, you don't know how to deal with it. You don't know how it manifests in your brain.
No.
So at the time, you don't know that that's what you're thinking.
No.
You have no idea. Being able to look behind sight is great, but at the time, you just think, what's wrong with me? What did I do wrong? And then progressing on to that is, how do I win them back? What have I got to do to be more popular? Because that's all it is at school. It's a popularity contest. Always has been. Hopefully it won't always be that way. But
I think that's the nature of growing up, though,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
That's just life.
But it was quite brutal. I mean, that kind of flipped it. I started getting into a lot more trouble at school. Detentions every week. Teachers, every relationship I've had with teachers, they really like me, but they don't like what I do. So I could sit down with teachers and have a chat with them and be really civil, really friendly with all of my teachers. But then in a classroom, they would hate me. And so that moment is where it flipped, where I just thought, I need to start winning people back. I need to do something. I need to, whether change myself, there's something wrong with me. I need to do something to win these people back. And so I just got worse and worse and worse until kind of inevitable happened. And mum took me out of school just because I was causing so much trouble. I did get into quite big trouble. That was only when I was about 10 for something I didn't do. And all of the teachers turned on me. The headmaster said he would expel me, even though I didn't do it, which is another issue that kind of dragged on throughout my whole life from that moment. But yeah, and then I got taken out of the school and moved somewhere else.
Very interesting. It's like this perpetual feeling of not being good enough, right? Which blights so many people,
yeah,
me included. How would you describe that feeling of not feeling good enough?
It's a tough one to describe, because when you're in that moment, I mean, a lot of my growing up is quite a blur to me. Just got to a point where I've almost blanked it out. But when you're in the moment, you're not feeling as if they don't like you. There's just something in your head which is driving you to do these stupid things to impress people. There's no And there's nothing in your head saying, I need to be liked, I need to be liked, I need to be liked. It just happens in your behavior. And that is the most difficult thing to deal with, because as a kid, you don't understand it.
No, subconsciously.
You're constantly being told that you're a troublemaker, that you've got all these problems. You're, as I said, you've got so much intelligence, but you don't do anything. You're a troublemaker. And so you don't know at the time, which, as I said, is the biggest struggle, because it snowballs. It rolls down the hill and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, because you don't understand what's going on in your head. You don't know how to fix it. There's no help being offered to fix it. There's no understanding. You don't feel like anybody understands you. And I always put it down to lack of impulse control, is what I was told. I couldn't control my impulses. But
that's natural. We're talking about the age of 6 to, let's call it 13, where you become a little bit more wiser at least.
Yeah.
But 6 to 13, you have no idea how your behaviour's unfolding in front of you.
Yeah.
It comes to you naturally.
Mm.
But you were told at school that, you were told various things growing up that you've told me. And this kind of set the scene for you beginning to realise the schooling environment or the education system as it stands wasn't quite right for you.
Yeah.
How did that progress?
It's tough to say that it wasn't for me. I have a lot of regrets with how I treated school. If I could go back and do something differently, I definitely would do it. But it was just too much of a closed space. There was nothing that interested me. I wasn't engaged in any of the topics I was doing. I managed to get through my GCSEs. I somehow managed to do it. I did absolutely no work. You get people who do say, I did no work for that exam, when they've actually spent hours and hours studying. You know me, I did...
No, I know you didn't do any work.
Nothing. I did nothing. I got a few A's and a few B's, which is all right, not for doing nothing. but that was... Because I was constantly being told that as well. I was constantly being told by mum that the school environment isn't right for you, it's not right for you. Once you get out of it, you'll be great. And so when I was in the school system, I was thinking, why am I here? What's the point? None of this stuff is going to lead me forward in life. None of the stuff that I'm learning is in any way relevant to anything I want to do.
Mm.
I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew it didn't involve the sciences, the maths, things like that. No. I knew it didn't. It didn't involve that stuff.
What did interest you?
That's another thing. Nothing. Nothing interested me. There was nothing I found growing up that truly interested me. Something that I was passionate about. Sport, yeah, rugby. Rugby was up there. I was very passionate about rugby, but it didn't spark a fire in me. And that is something that I'll probably go on to talk about later, is growing up feeling as if I had a lack of emotion.
Mm.
As if I had I was devoid of any feelings.
Mm.
I didn't feel regret. The only feeling I could feel was anger. That was it. I could only feel angry. I didn't feel regret. I didn't feel happy, anything like that. I didn't feel motivated. There was nothing, absolutely nothing that I can say interested me growing up.
Mm.
I don't know if you're an outside source. You could tell me if there was something that you saw.
My kind of question is, and it's the first time I've heard that, but I knew school wasn't right for you, but I think my question kind of revolves around was your lack of interest in school because you saw yourself as this like rebellious figure who thought, do you know what, fuck it, don't need you, stemming from that moment in the playground where people have deserted you and therefore you feel like perhaps this environment you're in isn't quite right? Or was it genuinely just a lack of interest in school topics? Because I think everybody has topics they're good at. I mean, I was crap at maths and science, good at English history, PE. But I also understood the importance of school, and albeit I didn't get the best grades, and there was a lack of interest for me too, but I saw the importance of school. Are you saying you did find the importance of school, you just couldn't bring yourself to be motivated to go through the system?
No, at the time, I didn't see the importance of school.
Right.
I saw it as, to me, the schools that I went to, so I moved around to three different schools, and the social opportunities were amazing. It taught, it gave me a lot of chances to meet a lot of people. It built my social skills massively, the people that I met. But the actual schoolwork throughout my whole school career, I just thought, why am I here? This doesn't do anything for me. This is, I don't need this. I could be out doing something else. I could be out earning money, because that was a big thing in my head. And it was about being rebellious as well. I generally am the kind of person who just goes completely against the flow. I don't enjoy being grouped in with everybody. If everybody's doing something, I want to be doing the other thing. And yeah, that rebellious nature was something that I never controlled or curbed, and it all built up into this thing where I just squandered a hell of a lot of opportunities.
Like what?
Just school. I mean, I don't have A levels. I don't. You don't need them, but they're definitely good to have. Like, if you can get them, get them. I at the time I thought, I don't need these. I'm going to go off and do great things. Who needs results? I was told by my head of year that I was going to be homeless.
Yeah.
Before I left school, he said, "You'll be homeless. You don't have anything."
Yeah, let's talk about that, because there's a couple of comments that ring true really with you, which is almost a bit like a fuck you. I mean, not mentioning names because who knows who's going to be listening to this, but what are the kind of comments that you received when it was becoming clear to you, teachers, heads of year, heads of school, mum, dad, that the education system wasn't right for you, and you were kind of breaking away?
I mean, so towards the end of my A-levels, I spent probably a month and a half bunking lessons. I spent a long time just not wanting to face up to the reality that I'd fucked it. And all of my teachers, as I said, the running theme is all of them are just so disappointed. They said you could have been straight A's, A stars, if you'd just done the work, if you just found a little bit of motivation. I said, I was told I'd be homeless. I don't know how serious he was. but he said I'd be homeless. I actually saw him at the rugby recently, and I walked up to him and said, "I've still got a home."
That's good.
I didn't call him sir. I was told I'd be homeless. That was just the disappointment I saw on people's faces. Like my housemaster, he stuck by me through everything. Mr. Bingham, he's just an
unbelievable
absolute
bloke. Yeah,
he just stuck by me through everything. He got me out of loads of trouble. He'd worked his arse off for me, and my repayment was a big fuck you. I don't want to sit these exams. I don't want to do this. Why am I here?
Was there any moment in that process where Mr. Bingham is bending over backwards to help you out, and almost trying to instill this this consciousness that within you that actually this might be the right path to go down, might be the wrong path to go down. Was there disappointment in yourself at the time?
No, I was angry. I wasn't angry.
What were you angry about?
I was angry that I was getting ripped out of school. I didn't want to sit my A-levels. I was angry that I was called in, told I had to leave. They didn't want to expel me because it cost them money to expel me. They're asking me to leave. That was their line. I was angry at them, of all people, and they at the school. I was angry at the school. When I look back now, I'm thinking, why was I angry at the school? They did everything they could for me. Yeah. When you're there at the time, you're not thinking that. You're thinking these people are out to get me. They're kicking me out of a place that I love. They're kicking me out of, they're getting, making me be removed from all my friends, my girlfriend, things like that. And I hated them for it. But you said about Mr. Bingham, actually, it's quite funny because he could see it coming. He could see the end coming. But he probably for about 2 or 3 weeks before, he had a chat with Mum. And then his attitude started to change a bit. He started saying to me, "You're going to do great outside of school." He said, you're going to do just fine. Don't worry about it. You'll go on and do, I know you're going to go on and do great things. You'll have to come back when you leave.
I have respect for him for that.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say about Mum as well. I wouldn't be alive without Mum.
No.
I spoke to her about it last night. She was the only person I can say who was there no matter what. Everybody at one point flipped on me, whether it was a teacher that had my back, and then it just got too much. Mum was the only person who stood by me through everything I did to her, everything I did at school, everything I did to a lot of people. She was always there, whether she had to lie for me, and whether she had to bail me out, whether she had to do anything like that, she was always there.
Let's talk about your lowest points. I was at uni, as you said before.
Yeah.
Classic uni student who would come home and enjoy time with his family, but be wanting to go back up to uni to get bollocks again.
Yeah.
Where did the deepest rut begin?
I have probably 2 or 3 points where I was at my lowest, horrifically low. And I don't think you were there for any of them, which is well done. Got out while you could. when I was at Bishop Ramsey, so that was when I was 11 or 12. It was a great school. I met some great people. But it being a state school and us being from a private school background, and our parents being well off, going there, I was seen as the rich kid.
Yeah.
And I had to play into that.
Yeah.
But I didn't know as a kid that Mum and Dad were going through really hard times at that point.
No.
They were really struggling.
Yeah.
And so I had no idea about that. And so I was nicking money off them almost every day.
Yeah.
Just taking money off them constantly. Going and not even spending it on myself. Going and buying things for other people. I had a friend who needed a bike chain. I'd be like, "I can get you a bike chain. I've got loads of money." I started eating horrific amounts of sweets and things just to, because that's what you do when you're a kid. But when you have access to money, your head is only going towards bad food. I go get chips after school every day. I ballooned, absolutely ballooned in weight.
It's just binge eating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Because you hate yourself.
Yeah, pretty much. I was so ashamed with what I was doing that I had to compensate with eating food. And trying to get people to like me. I was just so ashamed. But then the high of the food and the people liking me, being like, "You're the best, you're such a good friend," all this stuff, really pushed that down. It pushed it deep inside. I hid it completely. So I feel like a little bit of shame when I took the money, and then I'd be off and be like, "I'm
where you got your with my friends." Dopamine release.
Yeah, exactly. And then Mum and Dad found out. They looked and saw just how much I'd taken. And at that point, I just collapsed. Mum was like, "We're taking you out of the school. You're not allowed to see any of your friends again." I was 12 years old. So I didn't really understand the kind of pure consequences of it. Dad was saying he's going to call the police, all this stuff. And then at that point, I had to spend... they took me out of the school before the year finished. And then I spent 2 or 3 months locked inside. And that's where I didn't address any of my demons. I didn't do anything to help myself. I didn't even take any accountability for it.
You're 12, 13
exactly.
years old.
Yeah, like. Exactly. Exactly. And I didn't address anything. With Mum tried to help me. She sent me off to therapy. I didn't want it because I didn't think there was anything wrong with me, which is a big issue that I've had when I've been sent off to these places, is not believing there's anything wrong with me. And also my rebellious nature, just being like, "Big fuck you." So, yeah, and then I entered this weird stage of being really young, but having such severe depression. I didn't want to leave my bedroom, lights off. I remember it as if it was yesterday, having the lights off, didn't even want to watch TV. Why would I get out of bed? I just sat there smuggling food into my room, sitting there eating, crying for months on end. Spent 2 months every day just sitting there absolutely tearing into myself, but not for because I'd done anything bad. It was more like, why did you get caught? Mm-hmm. But that was one that kicked off a lot of that kicked off kind of the dark period for me. And then it carried from 13 when I went to Mill Hill. I always had a problem with lying. It's something that I'd do so easily. I would, if someone asked me a question about something and I saw this opportunity to make myself look good or to make myself seem as if I have something even though I don't have it, I'd always lie just like that within seconds. And it wasn't a conscious decision. It was just something that naturally just flowed out of me.
It's a subconscious habit, which you equate to getting people to like you, getting people to notice you.
Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, I pushed through fourth form, so year nine. I did have a lot of fun. I made friends. I was just, again, just really loud. I went out of my way to get people to like me. It damaged so many relationships. Mm. There's so many people I wish I was friends with now who, when people talk about me, they just go, he's a dickhead.
Yeah.
He's an arsehole. He's this. Why would I want to see him? And these are people I genuinely liked. Mm. And I wish I hadn't treated them in that way. That kind of carried and through till I got to another ridiculously low point, which was when I was about 16. I was battling a lot with not liking myself, but now it was a genuine disgust for myself.
Yeah.
It was attractiveness, not liking my teeth, not liking my body, things like that. It didn't help when you're calling me fat all the time. you and your mates coming over. But you did apologise for that, so that's fine. When you get to that kind of age where, I mean, 13, 14, 15, girls start to become really attractive.
Of course.
You see your mates going off and pulling girls and you're just there like, why aren't they coming to me?
Yeah.
What's my problem?
Yeah.
And it was, everybody thinks I'm the most confident person in the world. Everybody thinks I'm full of confidence. Completely false. Completely false confidence. I feel like I am. But back then, they'd all think I'm really confident and I was just bricking it. Every single thing I did, I was an absolute nervous wreck. But I put on a fake kind of front and pushed through it and got it done. But yeah, 16, started struggling with my image, my as I said, just a disgust for myself. It was something that really, really took me into some dark corners. There was points when I was 16 where I wanted to kill myself. I was prepared to do it. I remember an evening around November time, there was a mufti day. And you know how mum and dad are. It's, you've got clothes, so they'll give it to me. And all of the people at the school I went to came in with the brand new shoes, brand new clothes. And I came in with your secondhand clothes. And I got ripped to shit for it. I got absolutely torn to pieces for it. And I laughed every bit of it off. I was just like, ha ha, fuck you, ha, all this stuff. I went home and I just burst into tears. I shut my door and I thought, I've got to get out of it. What's the point? I can't see how this is ever going to change. I'm never going to be attractive. Mm. No one's ever going to like who I actually am. They're always going to know this fake. This is when I started to realize I was just fake, completely fake. They're always going to like the fake part of me. No one's ever going to know who I am. I was struggling with having absolutely no emotions other than, as I said, anger and disgust. And when you've only got anger and disgust, that is it's tough.
Terrible energy, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's not like something that you're in any control of at that point. It's something that I wish I didn't feel like that, but your brain is still whirring away going, you hate yourself, you're fat, you're ugly, all this stuff. And I got to a point where I was looking up ways to kill myself.
Mm.
And I then, it was actually quite funny because it was mum. It's always mum. I was sat there scrolling through my phone, looking up the easiest and most painless way to kill yourself. And mum knocked on the door. It's like, dinner's ready. I was like, oh, fuck, I'm just going to have to leave it then. I'll do it tomorrow. And then it just continued like that for probably over a month of spending all my days thinking, I've got to get this done. How am I going to do it?
Why didn't you do it?
I'd like to say that was, at the time, it felt like there wasn't enough time. But I know that was my brain just being like, it was an excuse. It was dinner. Mum and dad wouldn't let me go out after dinner. So I'm not going to do it at home. So I'd have to go somewhere else and do it. Well, I've got school during the day. Oh, weekend. Got Saturday rugby. I can't do it. Sunday, I played rugby on Sunday as well. So
yeah.
I couldn't do it on a Sunday. And also in my head, I feel like it's a, when you're in that place where you're genuinely about to end your own life, there's something in your head which just tells you, is this a good idea or not? When you're at that point, you just go, fuck, am I actually about to do this? And unfortunately, there's so many people who go, yes, I'm going to do this. I was one of the fortunate ones where I just went, I can't do it. I've got too much to move. I mean, it's something that, a quote that I learned from a UK rapper is that suicide doesn't stop the pain, it only moves it.
It's very true.
Very true. And I was thinking, again, it was mum. It always comes back to mum. I was just thinking, I didn't care. No offense, but you didn't come into my head. Charlotte, dad, didn't come into my head at all. It was, what is mum going to do?
Yeah.
If I'm gone, what's mum going to do? I was thinking, she'd be so happy if I was gone. And then I was thinking, well, no, she wouldn't be happy. It was around the time that Vicky passed away, who was my godmother, I saw how much that affected her. I saw how broken mum was. And that was a big realization for me, was it's a struggle between nobody likes me and, I mean, the pain this is going to cause. And fortunately, I just thought, is it actually worth it? There must be something. There's something I can do to get out of this. There's something I can do. And then I went and spoke to mum. I told mum exactly what I was feeling. We went to see a therapist about it, which was...
Why did you go to see mum? Because you were in such a place where you wanted to kill yourself.
Mm.
Or you were assessing the options, essentially. Surveying the scene.
Yeah.
No,
I'd say I was in a direct place where I was going to do it.
Well, I mean, I was the same only very recently, early this year.
Mm.
Sat there and spoke to Abby.
Mm.
There's a similar theme there, which is obviously talking, and this whole aim of this podcast is to get men talking. But why did you talk? Why?
I hit rock bottom. It was literally die or talk. So I can't continue.
Cry for help, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't have this weight on my shoulders anymore.
No.
You don't see it at the time, but how much it weighs you down. Mm. How. So I say it's like I felt as if someone had a duvet over me and had the corners pinned down for years, years and years and years of just being suffocated by this, these thoughts in my head. And then I just thought, there's only one person I know who'd listen.
Mm.
I think it's It's about finding that person that you know will listen and not judge you for it. But almost everybody's like that. I wish I'd spoken to more people about it and wish I'd reached out to my friends, to family members, to you. I mean, we weren't that close at the time. Fortunately, we're really close now. But reaching out to your family, things like that, most people go through things like this. Maybe not to that extent, but most people deal with things in their head. They deal with their mental health. They have problems with their mental health. It's just part of being human. But reaching out and talking to those people, you're not going to be judged for it. And that was something that I struggled with. That's why I didn't want to talk to anybody about it. I was thinking, my God, I'm broken. I'm so problematic. I've got a problem. There's no one can fix this for me. Nothing is going to fix this for me. And it was just when I reached the point where I was like, I'm going to end it, I thought, there has to be one person out there who's going to listen. And it happened to me, Mum, who's also a trained therapist. So she... which does help.
That always does help, that one.
No, she knew exactly what I needed. But I think it's the way that I've always been, is I will always, as I said, I'll always lie. So I didn't tell her the full extent of it. I didn't approach her with the full, because this was when I was 16. I didn't approach her with the full extent of it. I told her, no, I had the problems, I need to go to a therapist. I went to the therapist and I didn't tell the therapist the full extent of it. And to be fair, it pushed it down a bit. From when I was 16 to 17, I did feel better. I knew that I hadn't got out of it, but I knew that I could continue the lie. And if this stuff comes back up, then we'll deal with it then. And then I got to that point at 18 where my whole world crashed down. And that was the darkest point. That's the darkest point of my whole life. That was another point where I turned to weed to combat all my stuff. I got kicked out of school. I was at home.
What triggered that, though?
What triggered which?
You just said that it was the darkest point and you got to 18.
Yeah, it was...
Was it the realisation that school wasn't going your way and society's norms dictate that you go to school, you go to uni, you're then going to get a job. But it was becoming clear that that wasn't your path, and actually the entire environment you're in was dictating a different path, and the path that you were on. I mean, has that got anything to do with it or not?
Yeah, I mean, I was struggling a lot with... So I was in a fairly long-term relationship. There was a few issues I had with that, which I won't go into detail, just out of respect.
Yeah.
But I was struggling with that. I thought that was going to end. I thought my school life was coming crumbling down. I was being told all this stuff, saying, you've wasted every opportunity you've been given. You've disappointed your parents. Teachers were telling me, your parents have pumped so much money, so much effort into you, and look what you've done. You've done nothing. I've been told I'll be homeless. I was called into the headmistress office, and I remember really nice office, but I punched a hole in the wall because I was just so angry at them. And it's a combination of that anger, absolute disgust in myself for letting myself get to this point, and just not knowing where my path was. As you said, it's that conventional, like, 9-to-5 never ever interested me, unless it was something or a place I liked being. Work was never of interest to me. That kind of conventional work was never of interest to me. I couldn't see where I'd be going. There was no set out plan for me. School was go to university. Yeah. That was it. They tell you, so what you're going to do is you're going to go to university and then you're going to come out of university with a degree. Did not once mention what you do if you don't go to university,
no.
If you don't have A-levels, anything like that. And fortunately, I did a lot of work in my first job outside of school with people who run lots of apprenticeships. And that's something that I'm so disappointed in the school. A lot of state schools do push people for that because they get money for it. Yeah. But private system, they keep your options as one. University. That's it. And you're told if you don't do that, then there's not much else you can do.
Yeah, but that's the business of private school education, isn't it? It is a business. pastoral care is arguably second to none. You'd probably argue it's none to second.
Mm.
But it is. It's a business. It's churning out people that's going to top universities. Yeah. And that's the number one priority because that is what the parents pay for.
Mm.
I was thinking the other day, obviously you know all about what's happened with me recently and this kind of journey that I'm really, I'm at the beginning of discovering what I want to do and how I want to do it or finding a purpose each day to keep me going. And one thing I was kind of looking back on was the pressure I put on myself to succeed, the pressure I put on myself to be successful, the pressure I put on myself to be somebody, do something that's going to have impact. And I put that down to having two parents who, well, one is very ambitious anyway, in Mum, who's doing great things with the company, with her business. And Dad, who had a very high-powered job in the media and was well known for a long time, is now obviously retired. Did that have any impact on you growing up? Did that ever come into your mind as if, okay, well, I've got to do something, I agree with that. I'm asking for your opinion because that's how I developed. But did that have an impact on you at all?
No, because I think we grew up at different times. Mm. We grew up at different, completely different points. I grew up at a point where when they started their business they have now and they had nothing. They're being screwed over by the mortgage company. They were in really deep points. Mm. So that's where I was. I was envious of you, really. Mm. That was what I struggled with growing up, was you. Because, I mean, it's... You were always seen as the successful one. Not successful in when you're that age, when you're 15, 16, and you're looking upwards, you see someone who's earning money, he's got his car, he's got girlfriend, he's got all this stuff, and you just sit there and you think, I'm never going to be like that. Mm. That was what was going through my head, was because I was always told I was so different to you.
Mm.
I was always told I was so different to you. So I was like, oh, I'm never going to be like that. I deep down, I did always know I'd make money somehow. But money isn't, and it's something I've come to learn, is money isn't the be-all and end-all of it. But having Mum and Dad in the positions that they were in, I didn't really get to see that. So I never had that drive in me to emulate or even surpass what they were doing. Or to kind of model myself on that. I was in my actual, when I was developing, I was in that really dark point of both their lives.
Mm. I always found, the pressure I put on myself to be a hindrance, and it's continued up until literally to this day, is actually the thing that holds me back is this... pressure that I put on myself to be impactful, to make something of myself, when actually there is no reality like that. That's just a figment of my imagination that I've concocted because of what I've been experienced to. But actually, if you look at it, there's no past or present. Sorry, there's no past or future.
Yeah,
there's only a present. Like there's only right now. Mm. The past is just is in your mind. The past is pictures and videos in your mind, and the future is too. I mean, you could sit here and be like, okay, well, I want the house. Like the status I put up on LinkedIn recently was, you can have the status. You could say, okay, well, I'll be happy when I've got the life I want to live. I'll be happy when I've got found the right one. Got the married and kids, or I've got a high paying job, or I've got a great car, or I've got a lovely watch. But that's all in the future.
Mm.
And actually, do you ever live in the future? No. You only live right now. And I think I don't know how you see this, but for me, it's this complete shift in their kind of paradigms of reality, which for me is having always lived in the past or the future, which is why I've suffered from mental health issues for so long.
Mm.
I now can look back at it and be like, yeah, I've suffered at various degrees for the last 18, 19 years. It's broken me the last year, but that was solely because I've always put pressure on myself to succeed. I've always felt I've not been good enough. I sat there when I was 16. I think you did a similar thing. I don't know whether you're trying to copy me. Might not be, but
it's not all about you.
Well, wait, you just said you were in that mindset, but I said to Mum, I want to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. You set these wild goals, and yes, goals are important, but you set these wild goals which then determine your levels of happiness, but you forget to live in the present, and actually the only thing that matters is living in the here and now. You and I recording this podcast, there is nothing else going on in the world, past or future, that we need to worry about, because it's done or it's about to happen, and we don't know what's going to happen.
Controlling the things you can control.
Precisely. Yeah. You could have a missile that lands on 49A.
Don't drop the address.
you could.
You might get a big blank there.
Yeah. Yeah. You could have a missile land in Putney, which is where we are.
Yeah.
And we'd be dead.
Yeah.
But that's the future. It doesn't matter. Like, how do you see that? Have you ever given it much thought? Is my first probably question.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that I've... So getting myself out of those places. As I was saying, when I got kicked out of school, I tend to weed massively. Really bad, bad weed. I was smoking every day.
Yeah.
Absolutely fries your brain. I was working a rubbish job in a supermarket, which I hated. Because Mum was like, you need to get out. You need to earn some money. So I did that for a month and a half. And then... I started a job that I hated, absolutely hated working in my first recruitment company, despised it. I moved into a flat which was tiny. I then quit my job without telling anybody I quit my job. I was sat in my flat completely alone with the windows. My girlfriend at the time, she was staying with her parents because she was revising for exams at university. She thought I was going to work. I was sat in this room with the blinds down all day, just going, what am I doing here?
Ruminating.
Yeah, and I was just getting delivery every day. I was doing all this stuff. And then came a massive turning point for me. This is all how I got to a place where I am now.
Let's talk about
it. Yeah. That kind of leads on to what you were just saying about the past and the future, and controlling the things that you can control. I got to a kind of point where my girlfriend and I ended things on kind of fairly mutual terms, but it was her initiating it because I was just in such a bad place.
Yeah.
She just couldn't deal with it, which you wouldn't expect anybody at that age to put up with the things that I was doing. The depressed state that I was in, but that flipped a switch in my head. I felt free. I moved out of my flat.
Why did you feel free?
Because I just, for the first time ever, I didn't have a job. I didn't have anybody to impress. My friends were all off at uni, so I didn't talk to any of them. I had no one to impress. I had no one who I had to pretend as if I was okay to. Absolutely no one. There was no one around me who I had to pretend I was okay to. I came home to Mum, and because of the experience I had with talking to Mum about this before, something in my head just flipped. There was a point where I just went, why are you doing this? Why are you sat in a dark room? Why are you working a job that you hate? What's the point?
Yeah.
You're getting back into those really dark places where you were before. And I knew in my head, if I went back into those places this time, I was not getting out.
No, no, no.
I wasn't getting out. I knew I was heading that way. When you lock yourself in a dark room for 2 months with no job, and all you do is sit there, play Xbox, and that's it. barely open the blinds, don't go outside, what's the point? And then it came as a blessing to move out of that place, come back to our home, our house, where I didn't feel I had to lie anymore, because it was just mum who was there. And so I talked to her about it, and she suggested I go travelling. And I said, I was a bit shocked that she suggested that. She said, why don't you just get away from here? Why don't you go somewhere where nobody knows who you are? Where you have the opportunity to just be yourself, and you don't have anybody who knows what you were like before. You don't have anybody who knows what you're going to be like later on. You just have people who you're going to be with for probably, you're going to see these people for like a week and then they're going to be gone. And so you can make an impression, you can almost coach yourself into being yourself. You can take it slowly, just be yourself. And I went over there, and it was literally, booked it 2 weeks later, gone. 36-hour flight for 4 months on the other side of the world, in the absolute middle of nowhere, teaching as well. The direct opposite, putting myself out of my comfort zone, the direct opposite of what anybody would ever assume that I would be doing is teaching. There is nobody on this planet who would ever think I'd be a teacher. And putting myself completely out of my comfort zone, which is something I'd never done before. It never happened at school, because I was like, why am I here? I'm never out of my comfort zone. There was no point in my work life where I felt mentally stimulated. I felt like I had a challenge. I felt like I had a reason to wake up. And then going over there, I thought, like, when I was sitting on the flight, I wasn't even nervous. There was no nerves inside of me. It was a weird experience. I remember having a cigarette in the Hong Kong smoking rooms. Just the most horrific place on earth, sitting there with a massive grin on my face. There's about 50 Asian men sitting there chain-smoking cigarettes inside a tiny room under the airport. And I'm just sat there with a huge smile on my face, like, doing, this is it. This is your chance to actually, like, start anew, wipe the slate completely clean. So I went over there, and I was myself. And
what did that feel like?
It was incredibly strange. Incredibly strange, yeah. But so I can't, like, when I talk to anybody who I was with over there, I can't stop smiling, because I went over there, I didn't lie. Before I went to therapy to sort out anchors for lying. So if someone asked me a question and I didn't want to lie, I know I have, she gave me, my therapist, who's great, she gave me this little remote thing where you can either take the path to the left, which is lying, or you can take the path to the right, which is telling the truth. And so I just go like that, that's right, that's left. I don't even have to do it anymore. But I got over there, people asked me a question, like, do you have a job, things like that. Straight away, and I tell the truth. And actually, people asking me these intimate questions, which I usually would be ashamed to answer. You want to come across as like someone who's big, who has all these things. Just being myself and actually opening up to these people and then responding to it. I still talk to them now. I'm still friends with them. They hit me up all the time. And these are people from completely different corners of the world. There's people from Eastern Europe. There's people from like Guernsey. Still all the Fijian guys. I talk to all the Fijian guys all the time. And they liked me for who I was. And I never, ever thought that anybody could ever like me for who I was. And that's where it flipped. That's where when I came back, I felt changed. I felt completely different. I thought, why am I friends with people who like me for what I was? This is my opportunity now to actually cut the bullshit and just be yourself. And it was just like a weight was lifted. I'm not sure if you've noticed just how much kind of happier I am.
Yes. Sure.
I don't argue with anybody anymore. No. That's one thing I used to do all the time. You know, the shouting matches that would go on. I don't fight with anybody anymore. I've got amazing relationship with both my parents. With you as well. We've developed a great... Mm. It's just in the past, I don't know, ever since January time, from about then onwards, probably even sooner, we've developed a relationship I never thought we'd have, which is actually just being friends.
Yeah.
Same with Charlotte. Charlotte and I used to... my sister, we used to be at each other's throats all the time.
Yeah.
And now I can sit down with Charlotte, even though I disagree with everything she says. I can sit down with Charlotte and have a perfectly civil and nice conversation with her. I'm building new relationships outside of the places I was in. It's almost become a blur to me, and it's strange to talk about all this stuff that's gone on because I've just gone, that's not me. I've completely disassociated myself with that side of things. Mm. I don't feel a need to be liked anymore. Mm. I know that people will like me.
It's interesting because from my perspective, what's going on in your brain is, or your mind is, this internal conversation with yourself, beating yourself up all the time, hating yourself. It is a voice in your head telling you you're not good enough, forcing you to compare yourself to others and coming to the immediate conclusion through this conversation in your mind that, God, you're never going to be as good as that, so just move on. And so you begin to take these different pathways down in life based on this conversation that goes on in your mind. And that's the biggest problem. Once this conversation in your mind takes over your entire life, as it's done with me, clearly it's done with you, then you don't live your true self. And actually, the one thing that brings human beings, in my opinion, the most peace is this self-love, is this I'm at one, I'm at peace with who I really am. I don't need to live a lie anymore. I don't need to live a life that I think other people think I should be living. I'm going to live the life that I want to live. It's also incredibly difficult to get to that stage.
But
you have to go, and I'm certainly not either, but you have to begin to kind of like transcend that conversation in your mind. Treat that conversation in your mind as what it is. It's a conversation that's fictitious, essentially. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It does not exist. There is nothing in this, in your world. We each have these worlds, and actually, if you want to break it down and be even more spiritual, like, we are the sum of basically vibrating atoms and molecules, and that is basically what we are. So why on earth does any of this exist? It doesn't. You could probably argue what we're living in right now is just our lens of reality, basically.
Well, it is. I mean, when you look in a mirror, you don't see what other people see.
No,
you see
don't.
Your reflection. That's what something, as I said, I struggle with my image.
Yeah.
And when you look in a mirror, it's completely fake. It's your brain telling you what it thinks you look like.
Precisely.
It's not how other people see you. And that is something that, when I started to realize these things, I just started to build this confident, actual, natural confidence inside of me. And I've started having feelings. I've started feeling nervous. I've started feeling like genuinely happy. I've started feeling sad, things like that. And that was something that I've never felt. I kind of centered myself on this path of, as I mentioned before, like controlling the things that you can control. Having this mindset of, I've got my own space, I can control my space. Don't get upset or angry about what's going on around you. It's got nothing to do with it. You can't affect it. Having the ability to control yourself and have effect on yourself is something that I've learned over the past probably 6 months, and it's pushed me to a place where I can say that I'm happy. And
for me, it's been mindfulness and meditation has been the one thing that, I would kind of cluster therapy and my therapist, Simon, who I'm going to record actually tomorrow. He's changed my life. In parts he saved my life, but also he's opened my eyes up to the art of mindfulness, meditation, but also understanding what the hell happens in your mind. And since I've been able to begin to get my head around the fact that I am living in my own little reality, and actually the reality that I live in is completely different to the reality that, let's say, Abby lives in, where I used to beat myself up about the smallest things, incredibly ambitious and driven, but nothing was ever good enough because I wasn't good enough for myself. And therefore, when I was speaking to Abby and people about this, she was like, it's so sad that you can't see what I see about you.
Yeah.
And that's this kind of whole point about mindfulness, is once you begin to transcend that conversation in your mind and say, do you know what? Is it worth it, me thinking this way, because it doesn't actually exist? None of it exists. Like, it doesn't. Then your life changes immeasurably. I'm kind of at the start of this and beginning to accept various things about myself, and also beginning to think, well, actually, again, doesn't exist. So every time this comes up, I have to remind myself it doesn't exist. But the point here being is, it's practice. It doesn't just happen overnight. This is an ongoing journey.
It's
where you're going
marathon.
To find. It is.
Yeah.
You're going to find things where you're like, oh my God, that's made me feel really uncomfortable in my mind, but why? It doesn't exist. I've got people, so I asked some people for some questions. I'm not going to say who's asked.
Christ.
Yeah. So I hope you're ready for this. One is somebody who has known you for a little bit now. You struggled at school a lot.
Yeah.
If
you couldn't tell by what we've just recorded.
Yeah. But what you've done now with your new job at Harvey Lawrence.
Lawrence Harvey, close.
Is you've settled in very easily into that job.
Yeah.
You also talked at school that you were rebellious, you kind of were prodding against society's norms. Whether you meant to do that or not is a different question, but that's how you felt, and actually the education system didn't work for you. So how has your outlook changed? Why have you settled so easily into that job? Because actually it's kind of not dissimilar to what society wants you to do yet. Actually, you were looking to go against society. You've always said you've been rebellious. So is it because the job's allowing you to be more entrepreneurial? Like, why has that changed?
Yeah, I mean, as I said to you, when I came back, I felt different. When I came back from Fiji, I felt a lot different. I had a drive in me to actually do something, get something done. I'm not, as I said, I mentioned to you, I'm not a conventional 9-to-5. I don't really enjoy that. But where I'm working, they give you your own space completely. Most recruitment firms are very target, KPI driven. They're bang, 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 bang like that. This place is, you've got your own desk, and specifically because I'm working a completely new market for these people. I've taken over, I've gone into somewhere where I have experience of it, but there's no one else in the company who does it. There's nobody else in the company who's done it. And so I've been given almost fairly free rein to kind of build this thing myself.
Right, so is that entrepreneurial?
Yeah, and also the company, just the people I'm working with are fantastic. The values that they have at the company as well is something that I never really connected, because I mentioned to you that I didn't have that emotion, I didn't have that feeling inside me, the motivation, things like that. But the values that this company has are incredible. They have this whole younger you philosophy, where they want, when you join, you write down a lot of things about yourself, and then as time goes on, when you go up the ranks, you get these pair of Converses with a nice, all the managers wear them in to work, and they sit you down and get you to talk about your younger self and how much you've grown and where you've gone to, and the developments you've made and things like that. And they care a lot about each individual person. They don't make you feel like a number. They make you feel like a person. And that's something that I struggled with at school. So my first job, I just didn't feel as if they got me. They didn't understand me. Nobody took time to understand me. Nobody took time to engage me. Whereas these guys, they've taken that time. They've taken the time to understand what I want, what drives me. Where the bomb's going overhead.
So loud.
They've taken their time to understand me, and that is something that nobody else has ever done. But I think that all comes back to me being myself, being a bit more open as well, actually not having to tell people lies, not lying about what I can do, not lying about this stuff. And then putting time into me. My manager, a guy called JC, who's great, he's only a year older than me. He looks about 40, but if he's listening to this, then he looks about 40. We joke about that, but he's a year older than me. And the time he takes out of his day to just spend with me working on things,
nice.
Actually personal time with me,
yeah,
has really motivated me like nowhere else has. And so I think that's why it's just finding a place that you feel at home, you feel comfortable in. Like the work, recruitment, it's long, it's a slog. But when you've got people around you pushing for the same thing, you've got your team is driving for the same thing, they have fun, they're not arseholes as well, which is what you find in that industry, which is why I struggled with it so much. Everybody's an arsehole. This place is just full of normal people who just, well, you sit there, have a chat with them, you can go to the pub with them, all this stuff. And yeah, for me, it was finding that place, and I think I'll be at Lawrence Harvey for a very long time.
Two more questions and then we're going to wrap up. Which one to go first with? Save that one for last. Watching me go through my situation.
Yeah.
The emotions that come with that. Could you relate? Do you feel like you could relate? Support? Like, did you feel helpless? Like, what were the range of emotions that you went through with seeing me? Because arguably you came back from Fiji in October and
November,
but there was a difference in you. And then seeing me who...
Well, there's a difference in you.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's tough. I think the reason why I'm here today is that kind of exact reason is you don't feel like you can approach your family. There are obviously some families who do talk about this stuff, but you don't feel as if you can approach your family about this. I saw you struggling. I heard from mum exactly what was going on, the suicidal thoughts, the
suicide ideation.
Yeah, the direction you were heading, and I was terrified, absolutely terrified for you. But I thought is he going to listen? It's not my place. If I jumped in and be like, I know you're feeling this, all this stuff, he'd probably just think I'm kind of some sanctimonious twat who's trying to do this stuff. But I think it's difficult. It's difficult for, because I'm just coming back and I'm happy and I'm renewed and coming in and just with a smile on my face while you're sitting there in probably the darkest point of your life.
Yeah.
It's a really, really difficult space. I only found out from mum. Mum, she does that thing where she says, I'm only telling you this, don't tell anybody.
Yes.
And then she tells everybody in the family, and then she expects you not to speak about it.
Yeah.
But then you go to Charlotte and be like, did you hear? Yeah. Yeah. So that's how that came about. I found out about it, and I said, I was terrified, but I didn't think there was anything that I could do to help. And I think that's something that is definitely completely false. They're just talking, just sitting down and talking can help. It can save lives. Like, if I just come to you and been like, I heard you're struggling, talk to me about it, what's going on, it's more listening as well. That's one thing that mum taught me is don't sit there and be like, I understand. Don't sit there and say, I get it, I do this, I feel your pain, things like that. Because you don't. Everybody's individual. Mm. Sit there and listen to someone and let them tell you what's going on. Don't try your hardest to understand it. Just take it in and then try to offer them support, solutions, things like that.
It's sympathy, not empathy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When you tell someone you understand it, then they kind of... It kind of diminishes what they're feeling. It makes them feel as if what they're feeling is common. But everybody's feelings are individual. That's something that I've learned. Everybody is an individual. And you have to treat every individual differently. And it's about listening. And I wish I'd done that. But, I mean, you luckily, thank God, got out of the place that you're in. And as I said, our relationship has just gone from strength to strength. I mean, even after this, we might even go... for a pint together someday. Who'd have thought? Actually, you can't drink.
No, not
a glass
really
of Prosecco if you pay.
Last question, and I'm quite interested to hear about this. What's the biggest thing you've learnt?
About myself or generally?
Both. I think you're still well on this journey of...
I'm only at the beginning.
Yeah, understanding what the hell is going on. And I think that's a process that evolves, but...
I mean, it sounds daunting, but I assume it goes on for the rest of your life. You'll always be discovering new things about yourself. You'll always be battling with things going forward, but it's enjoyable. It really is enjoyable when you get to that place where you're just happy. But the thing I've learned, I said the big one was the controlling what you can control. But just how... I'm not going to... It sounds like I've got a massive ego. But just liking myself. Like that's the biggest thing that I've learned.
That's not about ego.
Well, no,
that
I was going to say something different to that.
Self acceptance.
I was going to say something different to that. Right. I was going to say that you're a great person, but we're not there yet. But it is a part of that.
No, but you are.
It is a part of that.
You are a great person. That everybody is a great person. Yeah. Like you're funny. You're intelligent. Like. Cut all the bullshit. Like you are a great. That's the first step to loving yourself. Is acknowledging you're a great person. And when you can't look yourself in the mirror, I've had two or three people now who have come on to the podcast who have said that their therapist has sat them in front of a mirror and got them to run through all the things that are good about themselves, so they can see themselves doing it. Like it's the biggest priority here is saying you're a great person, because you are a great person. I'm a great person. I've just never really been able to see it, and I've always done things, stupid stuff, which makes me come across as if I'm not a great person. But fundamentally, I am a great person once I start living my own life the way I want to live it. I'm not living it the way I think somebody thinks I should be living it.
Yeah.
So you are a great person.
But yeah, that's... I mean, just being at ease with... who I am. There's always improvements to be made. I need to go to the gym. I need to do all that stuff. But to me, it's not. I wouldn't be doing that because I hate myself. I'd be doing it because I want to just improve myself.
Yes.
But where I am at the moment, I've never felt more comfortable with myself. I've never felt more confident. I actually feel like a person, which is something that I've never felt before. I feel as if the confidence that I have is not false. It's not making me anxious. It's not making me feel as if it's all a lie. It's actually just being myself. And that's the biggest thing that I've learned. Yeah, is just to work out ways to like yourself. Because as you said, everybody's great. And I mean, generally, that's one thing that I've... probably the biggest thing I've learned out of all of this is about other people. Is just... having the ability to understand people, as you know, and I've said before, me being a bit of an arsehole my whole time growing up, breaking loads of relationships, all this stuff, just for this need to be liked. But I've learned to accept people for who they are. Everybody is going through something. Everybody is dealing with things. Everybody is at completely different stages of their lives. Yeah. Everybody has issues. And just... rather than looking down on them, rather than causing any more problems for them, just be nice, be there for them, be someone who they can turn to, because that is a great feeling. I get my dopamine now from helping people.
Yeah,
even the littlest things, holding a door open for someone. Yeah, I was a bit of a knob and never used to do that. Like at work, holding a door open for someone saying thank you and giving me a smile. That's where I get my little dopamine hits from now. And so it's other people, and also liking myself is what biggest things that I've learned.
We've done an hour and 12 minutes and 50 seconds.
Lovely.
Waffled on.
Mm.
Thank you very, very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I knew probably 85% of that, but actually it's... it's probably the first time we've ever sat down and had a chat about each other's situations, and I hope you'll be able to take peace from sitting here and putting this out to the people that you want it to go out to.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I was slightly, like, I wouldn't say nervous, but I was...
That's very normal. Everybody who comes on this is quite nervous.
It's a really strange thing, but by the end of this now, from the start coming on, I was like, do I actually want people listening to this? And then by the end of it, I'm just thinking, let them...
People need to be open about this. Yeah. Like, this is driving this change in, and especially in men, and what I'm now doing with Get Men Talking and the podcast. The most important thing in life is talking, building relationships, and understanding human behaviour so we can live peacefully.
Mm.
Because there's so many people out there who are just who are frightened, worried. They live in fear. They live. They don't live their true selves. And it's the most empowering feeling to actually live the person that be the person that you want to be.
Mm.
And people now know who the Tom has been for the last 22 years.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully they'll get to know the actual Tom going forward, because that's what I want. It's not about correcting what I've gone through, because it's driven me to this point.
Yes.
And I can only take those experiences and look at them in a positive way now.
Yeah.
Because I have to say that it's got me to this point. But yeah, I'm just I'm a different person to who I was, to how almost everybody in my life will remember me as. And it's brilliant. I feel like I owe them absolutely nothing. I'm me, and it's a beautiful place to be. I hope that more young people, if there is any young people listening to this, know that it's okay to talk about these things. It's okay to struggle. It's weird. It's strange. You don't understand it while it's going on. You have no idea what it is. But it's okay. Talk to people. You might be struggling at school. You might be struggling at home, anything like that. But there is always someone out there who can help, who will listen. And the biggest thing is, like you say, leave judgment at the door.
Yes.
Everybody thinks that people are so judgy because superficially they are.
Mm.
But when you actually get down to things like this, there is not many people who's going to judge you for this.
No.
Not at all.
No.
Not at all. And it's something that everybody battles with, is that feeling of being judged. But something like this, problems with your mental health, your feelings, things like that, your closest friends, your family, they're not going to judge you for it. Just reach out and talk about it. It's very liberating. I can say that for the past hour and 13 minutes now. It's very liberating. So, yeah, thank you for having me on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening, supporting the podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already, and find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn through @TheRutPod for more updates on who's coming up next on the show. Special thanks to my team, Ricky Batchew and Phil Bateman, for helping me produce The Rut.